preferentially either those impressions and ideas of the foreconscious which have been left unnoticed as indifferent, or those that have soon been deprived of this attention through rejection. It is a familiar fact from the association studies confirmed by every experience that ideas which have formed intimate connections in one direction assume an almost negative attitude to whole groups of new connections. I once tried from this principle to develop a theory for hysterical paralysis. If we assume that the same need for the transference of the repressed ideas, which we have learned to know from the analysis of the neuroses, makes its influence felt in the dream as well, we can at once explain two riddles of the dream, viz., that every dream analysis shows an interweaving of a recent impression, and that this recent element is frequently of the most indifferent character. We may add what we have already learned elsewhere, that these recent and indifferent elements come so frequently into the dream content as a substitute for the most deep lying of the dream thoughts, for the further reason that they have least to fear from the resisting censor. But while this freedom from censorship explains only the preference for trivial elements, the constant presence of recent elements points to the fact that there is a need for transference. Both groups of impressions satisfy the demand of the repression for material still free from associations, the indifferent ones because they have offered no inducement for extensive associations, and the recent ones because they have had insufficient time to form such associations. We thus see that the day remnants, among which we may now include the indifferent impressions when they participate in the dream formation, not only borrow from the unc the motive power at the disposal of the repressed wish, but also offer to the unconscious something indispensable, namely the attachment necessary to the transference. If we here attempted to penetrate more deeply into the psychic processes, we should first have to throw more light on the play of emotions between the foreconscious and the unconscious, to which indeed we are urged by the study of the psychoneuroses, whereas the dream itself offers no assistance in this respect. Just one further remark about the day remnants. There is no doubt that they are the actual disturbers of sleep, and not the dream, which, on the contrary, strives to guard sleep. But we shall return to this point later. We have so far discussed the dream wish, we have traced it to the sphere of the unc, and analyzed its relations to the day remnants, which in turn may be either wishes, psychic emotions of any other kind, or simply recent impressions. We have thus made room for any claims that may be made for the importance of conscious thought activity in dream formations in all its variations. Relying upon our thought series, it would not be at all impossible for us to explain even those extreme cases in which the dream as a continuer of the day work brings to a happy conclusion an unsolved problem of the waking state. We do not, however, possess an example, the analysis of which might reveal the infantile or repressed wish source furnishing such alliance and successful strengthening of the efforts of the foreconscious activity. But we have not come one step nearer solution of the riddle, why can the unconscious furnish the motive power for the wish fulfillment only during sleep? The answer to this question must throw light on the psychic nature of wishes, and it will be given with the aid of the diagram of the psychic apparatus. We do not doubt that even this apparatus attained its present perfection through a long course of development. Let us attempt to restore it as it existed in an early phase of its activity. From assumptions to be confirmed elsewhere, we know that at first the apparatus strove to keep as free from excitement as possible, and in its first formation, therefore, the scheme took the form of a reflex apparatus, which enabled it promptly to discharge through the motor tracts any sensible stimulus reaching it from without. But this simple function was disturbed by the wants of life, which likewise furnish the impulse for the further development of the apparatus. The wants of life first manifested themselves to it in the form of the great physical needs. The excitement aroused by the inner want seeks an outlet in motility, which may be designated as inner changes, or as an expression of the emotions. The hungry child cries or fidgets helplessly, but its situation remains unchanged, for the excitation proceeding from an inner want requires not a momentary outbreak, but a force working continuously. A change can occur only if in some way a feeling of gratification is experienced, which in the case of the child must be through outside help, in order to remove the inner excitement. An essential constituent of this experience is the appearance of a certain perception of food in our example, the memory picture of which thereafter remains associated with the memory trace of the excitation of want. Thanks to the established connection, there results, at the next appearance of this want, a psychic feeling which revives the memory picture of the former perception, and thus recalls the former perception itself, i.e., it actually re-establishes the situation of the first gratification. We call such a feeling a wish. The reappearance of the perception constitutes the wish fulfillment, and the full revival of the perception by the want excitement constitutes the shortest road to the wish fulfillment. We may assume a primitive condition of the psychic apparatus in which this road is really followed, i.e., where the wishing merges into an hallucination. This first psychic activity therefore aims at an identity of perception, i.e., it aims at a repetition of that perception which is connected with the fulfillment of the want. This primitive mental activity must have been modified by bitter practical experience into a more expedient secondary activity. The establishment of the identity perception on the short regressive road within the apparatus does not in another respect carry with it the result which inevitably follows the revival of the same perception from without. The gratification does not take place, and the want continues. In order to equalize the internal and the external sum of energy, the former must be continually maintained, just as actually happens in the hallucinatory psychoses and in the deliriums of hunger which exhaust their psychic capacity in clinging to the object desired. In order to make more appropriate use of the psychic force, it becomes necessary to inhibit the full regression so as to prevent it from extending beyond the image of memory, whence it can select other paths leading ultimately to the establishment of the desired identity from the outer world. This inhibition and consequent deviation from the excitation becomes the task of a second system which dominates the voluntary motility, i.e., through whose activity the expenditure of motility is now devoted to previously recalled purposes. But this entire complicated mental activity which works its way from the memory picture to the establishment of the perception identity from the outer world merely represents a detour which has been forced upon the wish fulfillment by experience. Thinking is indeed nothing but the equivalent of the hallucinatory wish, and if the dream be called a wish fulfillment, this becomes self-evident, as nothing but a wish can impel our psychic apparatus to activity. The dream, which in fulfilling its wishes follows the short regressive path, thereby preserves for